This is the Financial Freedom Series, designed to show you how to cash flow your way to financial freedom. Brought to you by Lagos Financial. The road to financial freedom starts today. All right, we are back with the Financial Freedom Series. My name is Andrew Bean, and I'm here with my man, top mortgage broker and financial expert, Victor Lagos. How are you, mate?
Good, Andrew. How are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, mate. It's been a while, but I'm glad we're back to it, even though this is the final episode in our Financial Freedom Series.
I know. I can't believe it's coming to an end. It's been great.
Yeah, all good things do have to come to an end, but we've got the final episode coming for you right now, which is a top episode, because we're basically talking about how we can refinance the property that we purchased, putting it all together so we can keep the portfolio going and buy more cash flowing real estate. So, mate, can you just explain what it means to refinance your property and why homeowners and investors might consider doing that?
Yeah, so refinancing is basically getting one loan to pay out another. And usually the most common reason someone would refinance is just to get a better interest rate. And then that would also mean to lower their repayments. But when you're an investor, there's other objectives. It's not just about the interest rate and lowering the repayments. It's about setting up the right structures. So interest only, it's also about extracting equity. So if you're wanting to use equity as a deposit to keep growing your portfolio, that's another reason why people would refinance.
Okay, awesome. So like in terms of using equity, can you just explain, this is a conversation that I have with a lot of clients as well. Can you just explain the flow and effect of using equity for an investment property, how that creates 100% financed?
Yeah, so I think the general rule of thumb is to consider that even if your property is, say, worth $1 million, you can only access 80% of it. So $1 million is an example. It obviously could be worth less than that or more. But $1 million, if you were to access 80%, that's 800,000 total. So if you owed already on your mortgage, say, 600,000, that means you've got $200,000 of accessible equity. So a misconception is that people can obviously borrow the full $1 million. Well, the equity is obviously important for you. That's your skin in the game. For the bank, it's obviously the risk not exceeding the 80%. You can go higher if you pay mortgage insurance. If you're going to access equity to buy another property, it's typically capped at the 80%. And that's because you've got less restrictions in how much cash you can access. And another way, what we call it, is cash out. So cash out is when a bank will lend you the equity as cash. So then you can use that to put as a deposit, or obviously you can use it for other things as well. But the other way around it is if you bought a property at the same time and you don't have access to the cash. That's what's called cross-collateralization. And a lot of investors don't like doing that because it ties the two properties together. And it actually puts the borrower or the investor at risk, because if one property goes up in value and the other one goes down, you can't access the equity of the one that just went up because the other one went down.
Yeah, 100%. So if you're with the same bank, you're cross-collateralizing those assets.
Yeah, and you can still use the same rule around the 80%. Let's just use an example of $600,000. You bought a $600,000 property and you borrowed $400,000 from the bank to buy that property. You still need another $200,000 to cover the deposit. So therefore, if you had equity on another property that you used as cash, that's how you end up borrowing 100%, because now you've borrowed $200,000 from your existing property, $400,000 against the one that you're buying. Combined, you're borrowing the full $600,000. Of course, there's stamp duty and other costs, but we can account for that by increasing the equity that you take.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the conversation that what I have with a couple of clients with the buyer's agency, is that, like, you know that if you use equity, you're going to be paying interest on the deposit, the equity that you've drawn out, and you're also going to be getting a loan for your next property. So essentially you're 100% financed, and it's going to be very hard for that property to cash flow because you're literally 100% financed. So if you're only getting a 6 to 6.5% return and you're paying 7% interest rate, you are underwater. It's just strange that people don't realize that being 100% financed, that's a lot of finance against that property.
Yeah. I have that conversation all the time where people are like, yep. I ask them, you know, have you got access to a deposit? They say, yep, I've got equity. I'm like, okay, have you already got access to the cash? or is it just sitting in equity? They're like, no, I've got it in equity. I'm like, all right, so that means we have to borrow the funds to use that as a deposit. So therefore, the rent now needs to cover the interest on the purchase loan. Say it's a commercial property, it needs to cover that, and it needs to cover the equity loan that you're taking out to cover the deposit. So once you actually put the cash flow in to see how that looks, a lot of the time it's negative. So people need to be prepared for that. But at least it's tax deductible. And of course, for commercial property, the rent will go up with fixed increases, et cetera. And also we're working off today's rates, and rates will likely reduce at some point. So it's not always going to be negative, and it's still better than residential in terms of cash flow, but still something to consider up front.
What I say is that, like, what we need to do is we need to put together a pay down strategy. So there needs to be an aggressive pay down strategy to pay down that deposit or the part of the deposit. So it could be 20 or 30% of the commercial property, or it could be just 10% of the residential property. But for a commercial property to do what it's supposed to do, which is cash flow, there needs to be an aggressive pay down strategy if you're using all equity to buy that property.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah, you can't keep it in the negative cash flow position for too long, especially if you're wanting to keep growing your portfolio in your own name and you've just borrowed, say, in a trust, right? We've talked about this in a previous episode, where if it's positive cash flow or if it's self-sufficient, and an accountant or you're a particular accountant will actually write and say that it's self-sufficient and able to meet its financial commitments, well, then we can exclude it from your personal borrowing capacity. But if you're carrying it and it's negative, well, the accountant's not going to put their name at risk and say that it's positive when it's not. So that's why you've got to have that strategy to get it into positive as quickly as you can.
Yeah, 100%. And this is not like a magic formula. You will need outside money to be able to pay that down. The property is not going to be able to pay itself off. So when I talk about an aggressive pay down strategy, that's outside funds from that asset, from the actual property, to be able to really keep putting down that cash. And then once you get it to a point where it's about 20 or 30% paid down, that's when the property will start doing what it's supposed to do, cash flowing. You can kind of sit back and then start accumulating that cash either for another deposit or even paying down the loan even more. But in terms of like interest rates or like rates that we're going to be seeing for refinancing, say, a residential property right now, Victor, what would we see in the market right now?
So at the moment, we're looking at sort of mid to high sixes, and it's hard to know if that's going to continue or if there's going to be more rate rises before they start reducing. I think the media out there is sort of changing the story quite a bit. And then also we've got to consider global markets as well. So it's really hard to know exactly which way it's going to go. But I think it's good when you're doing your numbers to stress test it as well. I think maybe a general rule of thumb would be 1% above the current rate so that you're prepared for a few more rate rises. But it may not hit that, but it's always important to stress test it for yourself too.
It's no secret that getting finance for a commercial property can be a difficult task. If you're looking for a rockstar mortgage broker to kickstart your financial freedom, well, look no further. My man, Victor Lagos from Lagos Financial, has you covered for all of your commercial financing needs. Go to lagosfinancial.com.au. That's LAGOS financial.com.au for a free consultation to get you on the path to financial freedom today. So like just your general feel of being in finance for so long, is your general feel that we're at somewhat at the top of where the interest rates could go and they'll start stabilizing in 2024? I know this is like a bit of a prediction or take it with a grain of salt, but I just want to understand how you feel about where we are in the cycle of interest rates.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question because from my professional experience, I started in finance during the GFC. And in that period of time, there was aggressive rate hikes, similar to what we're going through right now. And from memory, we were hitting these sort of levels as well, sort of that 6-7. I believe I used to see 8% rates as well, but that was for non-banks. And non-banks at the moment are sort of at that 8-9% anyway. So I think it's a fine line between if you go too high and no one can afford to buy anymore and the economy stops moving. So that's the game that they're playing, right? They want to reduce spending, but if they go too far and nobody can buy because they can't borrow, well, then another man's spending is another man's income. So then income starts to drop across the board for everyone. And then unemployment starts to drop because people aren't receiving the income to pay staff. So therefore, it's a flow-on effect. And as we know, our entire economy is tied around property, including state governments with stamp duty, including construction industry, which is a massive industry, and how many tradies get employment and jobs. So it keeps Australia moving. So I don't think my feel is that they're not going to push it so high that they're going to crash the entire market because nobody wins. So I do think we're sort of at that peak level, because even right now, there's less and less people that can show borrowing capacity to even demonstrate what they currently owe. And these are people that can still comfortably feel like they can borrow again and buy something else. But according to the bank, they can't. And that's because of the stress test that exists right now is 3% above the current rate. So if you're borrowing at 7 and the bank's assessing at 10% principal and interest, well, how many people can afford 10%? So that's why not many people can actually borrow, even though that's just to work out their current loans. Once you throw on extra debt, yeah, it's getting really, really tough at the moment. So yeah, I think we're definitely at that towards the peak. There could be one or two left, but others say that that's it. What do you think?
And weren't they talking about, you know, in a previous episode, we were talking about how the rate that they were actually going to assess you would only be 1% above the rate right now because of like just the common sense factor. Has that not come into play?
In some instances, yes, but only for big banks. APRA has given a special ruling for refinances just to allow people to get out of the mortgage prison, where they'll just give them a 1% buffer. That's a special circumstance. Not all banks, only a handful that allow that.
Oh, okay.
And a couple of non-banks have adjusted their buffers to 1% above actual. But the majority are still using 3%. So it's not official. So common sense, yeah, it makes sense. I agree with you. Only put 1% because how high could the rates go? But imagine they applied that 2.5 years ago and they said, let's only go up 1%. Like, it would be in a very different position right now if they were lending people, can they stress test 3%? Let's give them the money. And now we're sitting at 6 and above. Like, that's a massive jump compared to what they calculate. They've already exceeded the stress test. 3% above, say 2% was like 5, maybe 5.5. So now we're above that. So you see why it exists. It's for that particular reason.
Yeah. And are you seeing or hearing that there are foreclosures and there's blood in the street where people are losing their houses? Because it's not really widely reported that that's actually happening. But I know that it somewhat is in the background.
No, I'm actually not hearing anything like that right now. So I actually think that hasn't happened because we had COVID where people were building up cash buffers. And people, yes, they were spending when they were able to, but they were also saving. People weren't able to travel to Europe or America or wherever they used to take their annual trips. And some of these trips can cost tens of thousands if you're a family. And people were able to keep that in their offset accounts. So I do believe that there is some stress out there, but the reports that we're getting from banks and the data that they're sharing is it's a very, very low percentage of delinquencies. And my theory is that it's not just the fact that they've got some cash to cover the shortfall in the mortgage repayments and they're adjusting their household budget. My theory is that they're actually, people know what happened in COVID and that they said it was going to crash, but it did the opposite and prices went crazy. So because they know that, they don't want to exactly let go of their houses right now because they know if they can hang on for dear life, that eventually it will come back. And they'll make up their money and more. So it is a buyer's market right now. So therefore, sellers aren't getting the prices that they want. So the ones that can afford to hold it will hold it for as long as they can currently, because they know if they can and weather this period, they're going to make a lot more money. So that's my theory.
Yeah, well, there is definitely a property boom right around the corner. Housing prices for residential and commercial, they haven't really gone down. It's more like stayed stable or gone up. There are a lot of great places and markets across Australia with residential property, particularly, that they've seen 8% growth in 2023. And 8% growth is classed as a property boom. It's just because it's not in Sydney or Melbourne, it's not widely reported. But there are so many different markets in Australia that are officially booming with an 8% increase on last year on 2023. And once interest rates do start stabilizing and there's a bit more clear sentiment in the market where people are sure that interest rates have stabilized and they're going down, there's going to be a flood of investors back to the market. And that's only going to push housing prices and commercial property prices up. So there are some very, very good minds that have been looking at the property market for a very long time. And everything I'm reading and hearing and seeing points that there's going to be as a big property boom around the corner.
Yeah, well, so there you go. More and more people are probably coming to that same conclusion and aren't in a rush to sell. So good.
That's
assets.
Right.
Yeah.
So, mate, in terms of like refinancing, what are some of the asset types that people can use, like refinance their property to buy? I mean, it's not just property, surely. So can you just go through a couple of the different asset types that, you know, people do use the equity from their houses or their commercial properties to further their investments?
Yeah, so I guess if you think about some examples, if someone's owner-occupied property has gone up in value, they want to buy another property. Commercial one, as an example, I'm doing one right now. And they're sitting on about 300K in equity. So that 300K is to cover the deposit on a commercial property for 700,000. So that's able to cover 45% deposit plus stamp duty plus buyer's agent fees and costs. So therefore, it becomes a staged scenario. We have to do a residential loan first, ask the bank to refinance their existing loan, and give them another 300K as cash out. And then what we do is we split the loan and we give them a second loan split for the cash out, and we structure that as interest only. And the reason why we do it as interest only for the second loan, for the equity portion, is because they're not going to use that money straight away. It's going to sit there until they find the property that they're ready to buy, the next one. They don't want to be paying interest or making repayments until they've used the money. So by having an interest only loan and an offset account linked to it, they can essentially pre-borrow the money and have it sit there waiting until they're ready to use it. So that's a typical scenario that I work with. And that money doesn't have to be used for residential. It can also be used for commercial properties.
And what about other asset types? What else can we invest in?
So when you say other asset type, you're talking about outside of property?
Yeah, that's right. So like you could obviously refinance and you can ultimately use the money for pretty much whatever you want in some most cases. So what are the other things that people do use there to like refinance cash that their line of credit for that's outside of the property realm?
Yeah, so it depends on the client's investment strategy and what sort of help that they're getting, and I guess also their experience. You also got to be mindful of what you tell the bank. So for example, if you told them you're wanting to invest into cryptocurrency, the bank's not going to agree to that because it's considered speculative and it's high risk. It's borderline gambling. So banks don't want to support that. If you're wanting to invest in, say, ETFs or manage funds or stocks, a bank will give you cash. They'll let you access that. But it all depends on how much you're asking for. I've done cash outs for over $1 million before. But not all banks will allow that. Some will cap it at, say, $200,000 or $300,000. And some will ask for evidence. Yep. So evidence, what can they provide to show that they're actually going to buy the shares or they're actually going to buy the ETFs? Do they have something from a financial advisor or an accountant to verify that? So yeah, that's usually the type of other investments you can put it into. In saying that, it doesn't have to be income producing. You can obviously use it to buy a car, things like that, or even a holiday. I wouldn't suggest it. But ultimately, once you have access to it, you can use it for whatever you like. It's only if the bank controls it and they ask for evidence that they'll have to pay it to whatever you've decided to invest in.
It's interesting how like you've just got to kind of keep it a bit dark on what you ultimately intend to use it for, because you can use it for like renovations on your house, which the bank actually in some cases will encourage that because it's obviously going back into the property, the asset that they're securitizing. But I thought it was funny when I was talking to a bank one time, they wouldn't allow me to refinance to buy commercial property. But they said, yeah, we're happy for you to buy a car. That'd be cool. Why would you want me to buy a terrible asset like that, but you wouldn't want me to buy a real asset that produces cash flow that I could definitely like easily pay you back with? Like, it's just those things that are like nuances. It's just banking's a big business. They just want you to go further and further in debt and keep on paying interest. That's all they want you to do.
Well, I can also tell you the reasoning why they couldn't help you release cash for a commercial property. It's because the regulations, you've got consumer lending and you've got commercial lending, and they fall under two different umbrellas of regulation. Consumer is home loans, residential investment loans, personal car loans, credit cards, and even buy now, pay later. Whereas commercial is unregulated lending. It's because unregulated means it's still regulated, but it's unregulated outside of the credit protection code, the NCCP, National Consumer Credit Protection. And it's a fine line that banks don't want to risk crossing because they get in trouble if they cross that line. So therefore, if they become aware that you intend on using it for commercial purposes, they'll just typically just say no. They can actually do it, but there's a lot more red tape and a lot more paperwork required where you have to sign off your rights and you have to prove that it is going to be used for commercial reasons under a commercial entity like a company or a trust. And I guess the other thing is they don't have the teams talking to each other. So like you have the retail side, which is your personal consumer lending, then you have the commercial side, which is the business. And that's why you deal with business bankers, and I deal a lot with them. And they don't usually talk to each other. And that's why when you tell them you're going to use a commercial, they just say, no, we can't do it.
Okay? How does like refinancing impact the overall cost of the loan long term?
It depends on the loan term you take out. So if you consider your existing loan, say it has 25 years remaining, and you approach the bank and you say, I want to access equity and refinance. Well, if you keep the loan term at 25 years, then that's actually going to be similar in terms of the amount of interest that you pay. It might even be better off because you're usually going to refinance to a lower rate. However, what you're doing if you do that way is you're reducing your borrowing capacity, because the longer the loan term, the lower the repayments, more interest you pay over time. So therefore, if you're wanting to keep growing the portfolio, it may not make sense to keep your loan term 25 years, 22 years, constantly paying it shorter and shorter. That's obviously good if you're wanting to reduce your interest and you're wanting to get out of debt. But if you're still in that growth stage, well, it makes more sense to actually reset the loan term over 30 years and to do the same with the equity and do the same with the next purchase. That's sort of the main impact, the overall interest that you pay over the time. And the other thing that I wanted to mention was more around the interest-only structure. But actually, sorry, the fees. So each time you refinance, you have to pay fees. There's going to be discharge fees. So the bank that you're currently with or the lender you're with are going to charge a discharge fee. If it's residential lending, it's typically about $250 up to $400. That can be per property sometimes. Then there's also government fees. That's around $300 thereabouts. And then the new bank or lender may also charge an application fee or establishment fee. So I usually estimate around $1,000 to $1,200 just to switch a residential to residential. But commercial, there's more fees. Establishment fees, exit fees, valuation fees. So it may not be that feasible to constantly refinance commercial loans because it's just expensive.
In your view, how frequently should you be looking at your loan to potentially refinance?
So it depends on how on top you are of how competitive your rates are at any given time. If you sit back and just assume that the bank is always going to give you a competitive rate, it's highly likely that, especially in the last 18 months, that your rates have gone above what new customers, new to bank customers are getting. So it's worthwhile just checking with your broker to see if your rate is still competitive. There's a misconception out there that your broker knows what your rates are and will always get you a better rate at any given time. Because before the loan settles, we, the broker, are the customer to the bank. Once it settles, you're the customer to the bank. So that means that we don't have the same level of authority that we had at the beginning once it settles. So we can't always just call up the bank on your behalf and get information to know what your interest rate is and what your new repayments are and what your balance are. Some banks will give us access, but the majority don't. So therefore, you need to stay on top of that more than the broker. There are some technology, and I'll talk more about that later, but at the moment, if you log in and you see your interest rate and you check with your broker to see if there's a better deal out there, that's the time to refinance. But it all depends on how long you've had the loan as well. So you want to at least have a year or two with your existing loan before you switch it. A few reasons for that. What you could do is actually call your existing bank, or your broker can do it, and request that they review your rate for retention purposes. So that means if, as long as you've been on top of your repayments and you're a good customer, that bank should be able to reduce your rate at least slightly. It may not be exactly what they offer new clients, but they should give you some sort of reduction to keep it competitive. And then once you get to sort of 12 months or 2 years, then at that point, it's probably time to refinance. But the other time you'd want to look into it would be when you're wanting to access equity. So we talked about different types of assets you can invest in. But if you're growing your portfolio, then that's the time when you need to know who's going to give you the most equity. And that all depends on the valuations. So you might not stick with the same bank. You might actually have to switch to another bank that gives you a higher valuation to allow you to access more equity than the one that you're already with. So that's another time to review it, time that you're actually looking at pulling the trigger and actually buying something else.
Yeah, fair enough. It'd be really good if, being the broker, every single loan that you wrote, you'd have it in a portal and you could see it like in real time, what interest rate they were charging you. So you could basically just go, boop, 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 boop. Yep, yep. Okay, let's fix that one, change that one. Let's call the customer here, like bang, bang, bang. And you could stay on top of it and really like basically managing a book of investments then, which would be really cool. Nowadays, what would you consider a good interest rate for a residential house?
A good interest rate would be low sixes. So between 6.09 to 6.3, even 6.4.
Okay. Commercial wise as well, what would be a good interest rate for commercial right now?
Mid to high sixes. So between 6.5 to sort of 6.8, 6.9, that's a pretty good commercial rate. Anything above that, it's usually the higher LVR stuff and the non-bank stuff.
Well, I'm just going to log into one of my loan accounts. And this is the loan that you moved for me, Victor, the one that we got a line of credit out against. I'm just opening up the account now for the offset account. Oh, yeah. So it's actually 6.04% that it's up to variable. So it's right on bang with a good interest rate right now. Lucky.
That was a close one. Tested me there.
What about, I'll check the line of credit. What would a good interest rate be for a line of credit?
So it's probably around 6.5, 6.6.
All right. So we're doing not very good for our line of credit then. It's at 7.14.
Okay. After this recording, I'm going to see if I can get you a discount.
It's so good. It's not changing my life much. But yeah, it'd be good to try and fix it up, but that's okay. Anyway, that's good. No, I'm glad we did that. That's fun. So, mate, in terms of like implications between like interest only and P&I, would you ever take out equity, a line of credit, and have a P&I loan against that, like using it as a P&I loan instead of interest only?
It's not common. It depends on your personal circumstances. So if you're at a point where you're wanting to pay back debt and you don't really have much you can claim against your personal taxes anymore, it would make sense to actually just do P&I on the equity as well as the main loan. I think that's probably the only circumstances. Interest only makes more sense because if you're carrying personal debt, like a home loan, you'd actually want to direct all your principal payments to that first because that's not tax deductible. So if you're doing P&I on your home loan and you're doing P&I on your investment loan at the same time, you're actually shooting yourself in the foot because the principal payments that you're making on the investment loan are reducing your interest, and the interest is what's deductible, not the principal payments. So whereas the principal on your owner-occupied, it's not deductible. So therefore, that principal that you've been paying the investment, you could have directed that to the owner-occupied, that extra repayment. So that's why it's only if you're out of owner-occupied debt. Your home's paid off. You haven't taken out any equity on it. Or even if you have, it's all investment debt. Well, there's no point in keep carrying debt. It's going to have to be paid off eventually, right? So you should then pay principal and interest for it. But it also helps your borrowing capacity with bigger banks to have P&I and not interest only. I want to just re-emphasize that it's for big banks. And when I say big banks, I'm talking about the big four plus, you know, your INGs, your Suncorps, your Macquaries as well. As soon as you start going to non-bank land, they actually penalize you for P&I. What I mean by penalize is they let you borrow less. So if you did a principal and interest over 30 years, or you did interest only for, say, 5 years and then 25 years remaining, that can actually hinder your borrowing capacity with a non-bank, because they look at the interest-only repayment when they calculate their serviceability or their borrowing capacity. Whereas big banks, what they're also called is ADIs, authorized deposit taking institutions. What they do is they'll look at the remaining P&I term. So if you did, say, 5 years interest-only, 25 years left, they'll stress test 25 years P&I rather than 30. So having a 5 year interest only can be detrimental to your borrowing capacity for bigger bank lending. So that's what I mean. It all depends. This is where I come in, because obviously I need to look at things strategically and consider where they're at now and what impact it will have for the next move. Because usually they don't want to stop with the next transaction. So having a great interest rate, long-term interest only, may not be the right move for you right now, because it might stop you from getting into the next property.
Yeah, interesting. So what are some of the misconceptions or the common misconceptions about like transferring a loan to a different lender? Is there like anything that you always come across where it's like, that's just wrong? Like that doesn't work. That isn't how it is.
Well, I think probably the misconception is it's probably that it's too hard. They think that it's a lot of effort. And because remember, when you buy a property for the first time, there's a lot of moving parts, right? You're signing contracts, you're meeting agents, you're doing inspections, you're talking to conveyancers, you're doing contract reviews, building inspections. So people remember that they had to do all that when they got the loan. So then sometimes they think they have to do a lot of that again, but they don't. All of that's done. They already own the property. So refinance is actually much simpler. They just have the same property and one lender now pays out the other one. So then when I explain that to them, they're like, okay, that makes sense. It's actually not that complicated. And then the other misconception is that it's expensive. So when people think, oh, if I have to pay $1,000 and new fees, then they think that that's actually not worth refinancing. But when you weigh up the interest on the new loan and add the fees versus the interest on the old loan, they're actually better off. The repayments are less, interest is less. So it makes more sense to actually refinance.
Yeah, you could imagine like the life of that loan, what it would cost to stay in the original product that's at a higher interest rate. It could be like tens of thousands of dollars difference, even hundreds of thousands of dollars difference. And then people are like, okay, I don't want to move over because it's $1,000 cost. Like it's just like really just short term, like short minded thinking, not understanding the full picture.
Yeah. Oh, actually, there's one more, and that is, it's too hard to switch all my direct debits and have new cards and have new BSB and account numbers and all that stuff, transfers. They think, oh, I don't want to do it. That's too much of a headache. Well, if you spent an hour doing it and it saves you 10 grand a year, what would you rather? Right? And I think that's another thing that people also convince themselves that it's too hard. It's not difficult to change your direct debits. I had my card recently that someone nearly accessed my money, but then the bank blocked it and I had to set them all up again. Like it didn't take me long. I just jumped online and I checked one by one, updated the card, done. Like it took me a few minutes.
And I think this is what the banks actually want people to feel like. They make it as hard as possible to move, or give you the misconception that it is hard to move, because they obviously want you to stay. I definitely think that that's a bit of a tactic or what they actually want. Can you just walk us through exactly the process of moving a loan to another lender and how it is simpler than you think? Because for me, when you helped me out with one of my loans, you pretty much did everything. Didn't really do too much. I mean, I did obviously fill out all the documents, put everything together, which probably did take me about an hour and a half, 2 hours, one evening to get everything loaded into your portal. But after that, I was pretty much out of the picture and just getting emails saying, this is happening, this is done, this is bang, bang, bang. So can you just explain the whole process of moving to another lender?
Yeah, you sort of hit the nail on the head, right? It's only at the beginning that you had to do the work, and the rest of it I handled. So if you consider the borrower, all they're really doing is filling out their details. And I do have a portal, an electronic portal, rather than an old form that you have to fill out and print and sign and all that. You fill out in your own time. And this is your address history, employment history, your assets, liabilities, your expenses. And then I have a custom document list that you need to upload. And I only ask for the minimum. So depending on which lender we're going to, many times we don't even need that much. We just need payslips, tax return, ID, and the loan statements for your debts. So if you can get all that, then I gather it all. I check it all. I make sure that it all meets the criteria of the bank. And I'm doing my due diligence as a broker. And then I package all that up and send it to you to sign. Customer would sign it electronically as well. So e-sign, DocuSign. And then I submit that to the bank, whoever that bank is. And then that bank checks it all. So there's also valuation required at some point or another. But the good news is that a lot of the time it's desktop valuations. So you don't even need to send out independent valuer to your house. And the bank accepts that. They tick it all off. They approve it. And then at that point, you sign a discharge form. So you as the borrower or customer, you sign a discharge form with your current bank to notify them that you're switching. And you give authority for that new bank to communicate with the old bank and allow them to pay out the other and allow them to transfer the mortgage and the title to the next bank. So that's why you didn't really have to do anything until you heard back later and said, okay, it's been approved. Now you need to sign these documents. So then you sign a letter of offer, which is the loan agreement, sign the discharge form, gets sent to the bank. They check it. You might need to update your insurance. So if you have a detached house, not strata, then you'll need to call your insurance company to make sure that the insurance policy shows the new bank as the interested party. And then you just have to allow that bank to pay out the other one. That's pretty much it. And then it settles. You have access to new net banking, new cards, and then you start setting up all your direct debits and pay your salaries into your new bank accounts. And that's it. Nice and easy. And if you access equity, you'd also see that available on net banking.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, at the end of the day, it is a pain in the ass to have to set up all the new bank accounts and change all the direct debits from a new expense account or whatever. But in that instance, we were drawing out 100K that I was using for another investment, so it was well worth it.
Exactly.
I mean? For a little bit of time, I'll take 100K. So say, let's just say cumulatively 3 hours of work, I'll take 100K every day.
Exactly. That's right. People are like, oh, I'd rather not spend the 3 hours and not keep growing my portfolio and not have access to cash.
Yeah, that's it.
Why?
If you have ever tried to run numbers in your cash flow calculator, you'll know how important it is to have the right inputs. Stamp duty alone can vary wildly depending on what state you are buying in. That's why you need to know the exact figure. Lagos Financial have a full suite of calculators ready for you to start crunching your numbers today. Go check out your borrowing power, budgeting, income tax, refinance calculators, repayment calculators, or my personal favorite, the stamp duty calculator, just to name a few. Go to lagosfinancial.com.au. That's lagosfinancial.com.au to start using these calculators today. All right, mate. So what are some of the risks and pitfalls associated with refinancing and how can they be mitigated?
I guess the real risk is not if you execute and if you follow through and then realize that it wasn't the most competitive product or it wasn't the right product for you or the structure wasn't correct. But I don't know how often that actually happens. It's probably more often if somebody goes directly to the bank and not through a broker, especially one that specializes with property investors. Say, for example, interest only, somebody was accessing equity, but they didn't do it as interest only. They can't just change it over later. Once it settles, they have to apply for a new loan again. So they have to actually do that at the beginning. So that's why I would say it's worthwhile understanding the structure, educating yourself, and also talking to your broker about it before you hit go so that you're 100% certain on the structure before you submit anything. And then the cost factor, look, many times people refinance because they want a better deal. And the broker sends them a comparison and says, these are the rates you can get. Well, that may not be the only product you can get. That's just the one that broker is recommending due to your objectives and also due to them being comfortable using those lenders. So if you want to also do your own research, if it's all about price, well, it's worthwhile telling that broker, is this actually the most competitive on the market? Because otherwise, I will probably want to look into it further. So then they might present to you options that they're not necessarily used to using. They might go to a bank that it's not someone that they're comfortable using. But because you've made that clear that you're all about the rate and the lower fees, then they have to consider using a lender that they more often than not don't use. Or maybe they've never used them. So there's that. And I guess the other risk is saying too much. When we're talking about earlier, you can't unsay certain things. So you want to have the communication with your broker and be clear about what's going to be presented to the bank that's going to allow you to get the outcome. So when you sit down at a branch and you start opening up about all your plans, that may not be the best thing for you in case you're doing something that the bank won't lend you money for. But of course, you want to use your equity to benefit your own financial future. So you need to work with lenders that will support that. That's probably it.
Yeah, I reckon that for me, one of the biggest risks that I would think that this is probably the biggest risk is the misuse of the funds if you are refinancing, taking out a line of credit, and it's the misuse of those funds for things that aren't actually building your wealth, like buying more real estate. And if you use those funds just to spend on things like that are material possessions that are just liabilities, they don't actually help your life and you can't resell them. And you just end up frittering all of that money away that you've drawn out as a line of credit. And now you've just got a bigger loan that you're paying down without any, nothing to show for it. I reckon the misuse of funds would be a massive thing because not everyone are really, really highly financially educated on the types of assets they could be using. So they could be using it for shares and things like that. And shares can go to zero, unfortunately. So it's a bit more of a risky game that you're playing. So I think misuse of funds would be one of the ones that I would think of.
Yeah, I agree with that. The types of clients that I talk to are typically a bit more savvy and they're a bit more educated before they take on that risk. But also I have to filter that too, because I have the right to say, no, I don't want to work with certain people too, right? And if I get the feel that they're not the right type of customer to access hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash, well, then I won't support that application. So it's like, I have to then decide as well. But typically, if someone does want to access a lot of equity and they've got a lot of personal debt, well, I would say it makes sense to consolidate that first. So consolidation doesn't give them access to the cash. So what I mean by that is if they're going to pay off a $50,000 car loan or credit cards, well, the bank will want to control that. So then they'll release the money and actually pay out those debts directly. And if they don't, and they do give them access, that's when I ask the client to make sure they send me a letter to confirm it's been paid in full. Because that's part of my due diligence to make sure that they're going to be in a better position. And then whatever's left, then they can invest it. But if they've just freed up a whole bunch of cash flow by clearing all these personal debts and loans and stuff, well, they're in a better position because their outgoings have reduced. So now they actually can think clearer and actually make some more investment decisions because they're not constantly maxed out and paying all their disposable income to paying off personal debt at high rates. So yeah, that comes into effect as well.
And how do you see like refinancing property changing in the future? Are there any like emerging technologies or trends or like AI that banks are using now to submit these applications, to review these applications? Is there anything like futuristic coming through the woodwork that's going to change the landscape of how we refinance property in future?
Yeah, it's an interesting time we're in at the moment, right? We've got a lot of emerging technology. We've got AI that's coming up. We've got open banking. And open banking, I think, will probably be the thing that's, when it starts to work well, it will make it easier and faster for clients to refinance because it just means that the transparency of their transactions and their repayment history, they just electronically consent and they don't have to log into net banking, download statements, try to get the exact dates, transaction histories, and send that and get the bank to manually check everything. When that is integrated well with the credit bureaus, so Equifax, and what happens is they can see automatically that you've been on time for the last 12 months or more. So then they'll happily just pay that bank out. And if they've got your open banking consent, well, they can see the BSB and account number and they can just pay it directly. And there's already electronic title systems, not in all states, but the majority of all states, called PEXA, P-E-X-A. And this is where you don't have a physical title deed anymore. It's just an electronic transfer that happens through this system. And the banks share it, and the state governments share it, and the titles office share it. And that's why you have seamless transactions already happening electronically when you're refinancing and when you're purchasing. But once you sort of put open banking and integrate the credit history in there as well, what will then inevitably happen is that they're going to start to review your affordability through these means too. They haven't done that yet. They still require payslips and they still require you to declare your expenses. But at some point or another, they are most likely going to say, give us consent so we can see your banking data and your loan history. And then we'll see how much money you really have left over after you spend all your money. And do you actually have enough to afford the loan? And if you do, we'll lend you the money. And if you don't, we won't. You see, that's where we're probably going to get to. A lot of fintechs are already using that in the car finance and personal loan space, but in mortgages and commercial loans, a bit slower.
Yeah, so I guess there's absolutely no hiding in future, no cooking the numbers a little bit just to get that little bit more finance over the line. What I'm hearing you say is get as much finance as you can right now before those technologies come to fruition. Because when they do, there's no hiding. You're never getting away from it. You're not going to be getting approved for anything that you shouldn't be getting approved for. And that'd be a horrible thing.
Well, one of our early episodes, we talked about how to prepare before you start borrowing money, right? And I think that's probably more prevalent now, because if you can get on the front foot and start managing your money so that you always spend less than you earn and save the difference, then when it comes time to apply for a loan with these technologies, you'll be like, here, I'll happily just share it with you. See that I'm good with my money. Because remember, it can work in your favor. Because remember, the banks use what's called the HEM, the household expenditure measure. So they're guessing how much you spend based on your household income, based on where you live, based on how many people are in the household, including kids. And even if you spend less than that, they're still using the higher of the two. But in the future, if you can show them you're spending less than that consistently, they'll have no reason to use the higher. They'll say, well, the data tells me you're spending $3,000, even though my estimates are $4,500. So that can work in your favor. But if you are spending $4,500 or $5,000, well, forget about it. It's worked against you. So that's why, get ahead.
No, that's a good point. Get your ducks in order right now for when this scary technology does come online, because there's no hiding. Big Brother will get you. All right, mate. Well, this has been a fantastic series. Really, really happy we got this done. They've been like few and far between. There's only been 6 episodes, but it's been very, very fun. So I thanks for joining me and doing this series, mate. Any final words?
No, it's been great. I've had some really positive feedback from the listeners. People have connected with yourself and me, and we've been able to help more and more clients get onto the commercial property ladder. Yeah, I think keep at it. I think at some point I'm going to have you on my podcast as well, because I really want you to share more of your story about self-storage and how we can help more people tap into that. Because it is, it's a lot of moving parts. It's not as simple as a regular property. So I think if we can find a way to help more people, that's what it's all about.
That's it, man. And we will have Victor on back again, I'd imagine. So don't feel like he's going anywhere. But just for this particular series, we're going to close it up. There could be a reboot. Who knows? Well, this has been financial expert Vic Zalagos and Andrew Bean on the Financial Freedom Series. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.